We are back with Olof for a follow-up episode. So how about getting started directly here? Have we seen any legal cases? Any been any lawsuits?
Around open hardware?
Yeah.
No. So I talked to Andrew Katz, who is the main authority on this matter, and he told me that there have been no court cases, at least that he's not aware of. And I think he would know.
Okay. So I have a question here for me as a software developer. I get the feeling that you're looking down at me because I only know software and you probably know both, but there you go. So what is it that is free or open? So is the can you explain it again for me?
Yeah, so as a software developer, I hear this question a lot. Many software developers are interested and want to get started somehow. They are not really sure where to start, and that is one of the main problems here, that it is perceived as two very different worlds, where in reality much of the actual work could be done in a much more software-centric way. And I think this would make it easier for software developers to come into the field. And we're getting there, but very, very slowly. And there's also a bit of different mentality. When I went to school, there was a lot of talk that we don't use programming languages. We use hardware description languages, and that is much more something more advanced, I think, was the implication of that. Well, in reality, I think it's just an extremely bad excuse for not keeping up with modern software practices. The tooling in the open source silicon world is and methodologies are 20 years behind that in software. There's no reason you should be feeling bad. I think what we should see instead is that software developers will be able to come in with modern software development practices, and we should listen to that because you have much more, you're much more advanced than we are in our field. But then again, it's what you want to do. It all depends on what you want to do. So if you want to create functionality in silicon, then you would probably learn Verilog, or you would learn VHDL, or you would learn one of the newer languages like Chisel or Emigen or Clash, which are different newer hardware description languages.
No, or you can work System C these days.
Once again,
no System C these days.
System C is interesting because it has been around for ages, and in some quarters it's very popular, and in other quarters it's just never too cold. So I always been a bit curious about System C. It's there, but it's not everywhere.
Yeah.
Silicon functionality, the IP cores, is one thing, but then also a lot of it is tooling. When the stuff I do mostly work in Python, creating tools for working with these designs, such as Fusoc or Idealize. So there's a lot of it is pure software, just targeting silicon.
I see it a bit from my old, like, I used to be a teacher, and when I taught programming to students, they went for like one course, a second course, and then perhaps in the third course, we used some kind of graphical library so they could do a graphical user interface. Ah, this is programming, they said. So for me, program is as soon as you see something like Hello Cleveland or something on the screen, you're fine. This is a program. But for me, it's hard, like, to see what would be the corresponding Hello Cleveland or Hello World in hardware.
That is blinking a LED.
I was about to say the same. It's starting your blink LED.
And I actually have a project called LED to Believe, which is an attempt to make make project files for all FPGA development boards in the world, so that you can easily get started with a simple blinking project and take it from there. So it currently has support for 52 different FPGA boards, but there are more needed. And it's also a good thing if people getting started out in the field, they can just supply a patch. It's pretty easy, and they can feel good adding support for their board or trying out an existing board.
Is that on GitHub or somewhere? So it's
like, yes, it's on GitHub.
Super.
I guess we can
put the link in the show notes.
Perfect.
So how many of these tools are free or open source? Do I have to buy a license from a hardware vendor company?
In most cases, you don't need to pay anything. And when it comes to FPGA development, an increasing number of FPGA now have fully open source tool flows. They are still in my minority. The first that got widespread acceptance was the Lattice I40 FPGAs. These are very small FPGAs that were documented by Claire Wolf, mostly. And we have, after that, we saw also from Lattice ECP5 chips. I think that was mostly Dave Shaw doing that. We have now seen some support for various Xilinx devices. There's work ongoing on other Lattice devices, on Intel FPGAs, on Gowin FPGAs. So in some cases, you can find fully open source tool chains. These are never endorsed by the FPGA vendors, except for one case, which I will return to. there are almost always free as in beer vendor tool chain you can get for your devices.
Yeah, and speaking about beer, I remember you kindly, together with Jonas, if I remember correctly, and for sure Julius, visited the conference I co-organized, FSCOS down in Gothenburg. And this is, I have a note here saying 2012. And we had a hazy night with lots of beer, and we discussed this. And back then, you had to buy the community was clearly not as vibrant as it is now. So it's kind of cool to follow the work you do.
That is very true. So we have had open source CPUs for 20 years now, starting with the Open RISC project. And we have had open tools, some tools like simulators, like Verilator and Icarus Verilog, that have been around for 20, 25 years. There's even been open source ASIC tooling in some way for 25 years or so. But the community is really, really coming together the past few years. And also RISC-V has been a big catalyst. RISC-V is in itself not an open source project. It's a royalty-free standard. But it has had a tremendous impact on the interest in this field and interest in open source silicon.
Yeah, RISC-V is interesting. I mean, we had a talk on FOSS North from Mikko Böhm about standards versus open source, and it's, you kind of approach the problem from different perspectives. If you're implementing something as an open source reference standard, or if you're actually doing a standard as you used to, but RISC-V is a standard, so to speak, with different.
Are you talking features. Like my kids? Either it's standard or it's not standard. There is no such thing as standard.
Here,
come standard. On.
Standard proper. No, but are there commercial implementations of RISC-V as well? And
yes.
Yep.
So RISC-V started out as a university project, as a base ISA, base instruction set for doing other types of research. And it was... I mean, there's so much computer architecture research going on in the world, and in many cases there's some professor who think it's fun to make their own instruction set, so they do that and force the students to use it. And this has been a problem because that has zero use in the real world. But this one was very well designed. It was also co-designed by David Patterson, who kind of invented the RISC architecture back in the days, which started MIPS and everything. So they open sourced it and they pushed it and they tried to get industry acceptance. And I think that was very much the key, and the world was ready for it. So today, so the first implementations were open source. But over the years, there are, I guess there are now more proprietary RISC-V cores being in use than open source ones.
But so you share the ISA, which I guess mean that then you can share all the tooling, like Clang and GCC and operating systems and all of that.
Yes, and that is the big thing. So you have the freedom to innovate on either side. So you have a lot of software people who are very interested in helping out here. We just had the V8 port, the JavaScript engine, just landed upstream, which is a big thing. We had Android support for the first time a couple of weeks ago from Alibaba's hardware section, which is called T-Head, I think they're called. And then on the hardware side, you have an ISA, which is a very simple base ISA, but where you have extensions that you can implement to tune your CPU for different use cases. So for example, if you want to build a very small CPU, you might only stick to these base instruction set. If you want to make a compute heavy one, you might add the vector extensions. If you're doing a Unix capable CPU, you want to add the hypervisor parts and atomic operations and things like that. So you can mix and match all these extensions and build a CPU that follows the RISC-V specification, but is very well tuned for your application.
And just backing off one step there. So I mean, when instruction sets or ISAs, as we put it, that's like x86 versus ARM. So you can't run a PC program on an ARM device and the other way around. And RISC-V is yes, another instruction set. And when it comes to these extensions, then it's a bit like you have ARM hard float, for instance, if you do floating point calculations in hardware, otherwise you have to do it in software. So I guess it's a very similar setup where you have extensions like MMX and whatnot that you can detect and either do in software or hardware.
Yeah, that's correct. That's a way to describe it.
Yeah. So what's the, well, I guess the trade-off that you're looking for then is sort of size of silicon and versus functionality. So if you do something simple, you can do like a microcontroller that uses the RISC-V world tooling, but you can also do something fancy.
Yeah, exactly. So the idea is to have something that scales from the smallest microcontrollers that you will find in deeply embedded things like power management controllers or just something that counts button presses or something, up to smaller embedded systems like routers or phones, which are already getting very advanced, up to desktop computers and all the way up to high-performance computing like data centers and supercomputers.
But how does it look on the other side then? So you have the whole software tooling, all of that set up, and you have the ISA and you have the CPU. Does it define like a standard bus as well, or sort of use something for peripherals, or is the integration always sort of a one-off?
No. So RISC-V only describes the instruction set, and that is very well contained to do that. On the other hand, there are other organizations like CHIPS Alliance, which I am also a member of, that tries to take a more holistic approach and pushes other types of standard related to this. So in the CHIPS Alliance project, for example, Western Digital has given away the OmniExtend specification, which is a bus protocol that builds on the Tilink bus, which is originally from Sci-Fi and now also in part of CHIPS Alliance. And it provides cache coherency over Ethernet, So this is one such bus specification that is now being driven as an open standard. Also, Intel is part of the Chips Alliance. They are pushing the open AIB chiplet standard. So chiplets is a very interesting thing. I think will play a big role in the future. It's kind of like instead of having one chip and then, or instead of having a lot of chips on a PCB, on a circuit board, you will have small dice and then put mostly all of the circuit board inside a chip and mix and match different functionalities to build up a chip that.
But it's actually physical dice that you then connect with bonding wires or something. It's not like IP blocks that you use to create an ASIC.
No, so you create these chiplets standalone, and then you can combine them through a standard specification, like the AIB specification. And that, I think, will change the way chip design chips are made.
I mean, my soldering skills went out of use when surface mounted came. So I guess this is the next level proper.
Really. It's all about miniaturization and cost efficiency and power efficiency and all that comes with it. I mean, that's the reason why things are getting smaller. It's to be able to cram more things into a smaller area and make it more power efficient.
But you mentioned that there are multiple implementations. That actually the commercial ones are, or the closed source one are more common when it comes to RISC-V implementations. What are the big ones?
So the probably the biggest one, I think, is Andes. It's a Taiwanese company that used to have, I'm not sure I got my history right here, but I think they had their own CPU architecture, and then they made a big bet on RISC-V. So they provide the price services around. They sell CPUs and they sell the integration around it so that you can easily put their cores into your devices. And then, of course, the Sci-5, which is founded by the founders of the RISC-V spec, which is Chris Jasanovic, Jan Suplee, and Andrew Waterman. And we have, for example, CodaSip, which has a very interesting model. They have their own proprietary RISC-V CPUs. Then they also provide commercial support around the open source course that Western Digital has provided through the Chips Alliance project. Also the Swerve, as the cores are called. In the Swerve support package, you also get access to FuSoc, which is a good thing to have. So there are many more. For example, NVIDIA has famously replaced all their internal CPUs with RISC-V CPUs. Western Digital, a couple of years ago, said that they will be putting out 1 billion RISC-V cores in their products, like hard disks. And they are a big player in the RISC-V space nowadays. I'm probably forgetting to mention some very important names here, but these are some of the big ones.
What's the main driver? I mean, I can understand RISC-V from an open source perspective, and I think it's great that it gains traction. But what surprises me is that you see a majority of sort of closed implementations where you have ARM, where you could just pick it up and it's established and it's matured over a much longer period of time.
Yeah, so there are different ways to answer that. And one thing is that RISC-V allows you to customize the CPU, which is not something you're allowed to do in the same way with ARM. So you can add and sometimes even remove instructions and make it tailor your, it's very much your use case, while still having this shared body of software. So you don't have to, it's kind of like doing your own ISA in a way, but with the support, but existing support in the tooling and everything around it. So it's a very good compromise in that regard.
This is basically more flexibility. Does the whole China-US trade war Trump thingy play in as well to create a perfect storm? Because it feels like it's correlating that RISC-V really takes off when the export restrictions start to enter the picture.
From my point of view, it it was already on a trajectory before this became a thing. But also last year, RISC-V Foundation was turned into RISC-V International and changed its base from US to Switzerland to take away some of the worries because they wanted to show that this was a truly global thing. So they wanted a more seemingly more neutral base for that. So yeah. And I also think one thing that's very interesting is that the European Processor Initiative, they chose to standardize around first ARM and then RISC-V. And a little later after that, also IBM open sourced their power architecture. And I kind of wonder if this was the thing that they didn't want to be left out as from these kind of projects. But I don't know. I don't have any evidence for that.
I mean, if you look at the software world, it feels like open source is slowly eating the world. So I guess once RISC-V gets a foothold, it's very hard to stop.
Yeah, that's the thing. So it's commoditization. So people want to stand on top of the shoulders of a giant. They don't want to continuously reinvent everything from tooling to simple IP cores like UARTs and SPI controllers and things like that. They want to add the value add on top of something existing. So it makes a lot of sense to reuse and share all the commonality because very few companies sell compilers, for example. So it's so much better to just use an existing compiler. Very few companies actually sell CPUs or processors. Most companies just use a processor for some kind of computation. And they don't have any exact demands, perhaps. They can just pick one of many existing. And many do choose open source CPUs. Like Claire Wolf's PCR with 32 is extremely common in many cases. And there are some smaller CPUs as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've made one that has zero users, so we're the smallest, at least. A jam CPU. I think it was back in 2001 or something. It was an interesting experience.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, it's really fun. And it's, I think it's good, even if I work with software these days, it's good to have that intimate knowledge of how it actually works. But I was thinking, so we've talked a bit about the closed source part, and I want to lead into your open source implementation, but I guess maybe we should, are there many open source implementations, and sort of how does the ecosystem look there?
Yeah, there are many open source implementations. I would say there are hundreds of open source implementations. And this is also different. I mean, I started out with the open RISC world, where we had one reference implementation for like 15 years, and then we had another, which started taking over, and then there was a third, maybe a fourth. But when it comes to RISC-V, there are just so many implementations, so you can basically choose the one that fits you best. And you can check out on RISC-V.org. They actually have a list of known implementations, both proprietary ones and open source ones.
But of course you should pick the serve one or serve five or however you pronounce it. what apart from the rest, what made you reinvent the wheel once again?
Yeah. So the thing is, I have made a CPU. I made a RISC-V CPU, and it's the world's smallest RISC-V CPU. I'm very proud of it, and it's surprisingly useful for different kind of things. But the thing is that in 2018. I was organizing OrConf in Gdansk, in Poland. And it was announced that there would be a RISC-V soft CPU contest. So you should do the fastest or the smallest one under some constraints. You should fit on a certain kind of FPGA board. And you had two months to do that. And I thought, that sounds fun. I will never have time to do that. I have too much stuff going on. So about a month later, I was doing the dishes, I remember, and I thought, I wonder how a bit serial CPU works. Can you like do it one bit at a time? And I just had to jolt down some stuff on the paper. I thought, this might work. So a couple of days later, I started just writing some Verilog to see if it would work even outside of the paper. And that's how we got started. So in about a month of evenings and weekends, I had, with three hours left to the deadline, I had a working CPU that fulfilled the requirements. Last things were kind of fixing up interrupt support. So it could run the Zephyr operating system, which is really cool, a small real-time operating system. So I sent it in and then kind of forgot about it. And then like a month later at the RISC-V summit, I wasn't there, but I got some tweets saying, hey, you won. So it turns out I didn't win the smallest or the fastest award, but I won the most award for the most creative core. That was a lot of fun. Yeah. So then I kind of realized there were so many things I did not have time because it was just a rush job. So over the years, since then, this past 1.5 year, I have made it smaller, basically. And now it's the world's smallest RISC-V CPU.
But the target then is to, is it to reduce the number of LUTs in a soft scenario or for power consumption or what?
Yeah, it's very much about size. So, I mean, if you need something small and soft, then I'm your guy.
Microsoft went well, so this is next level then. Yeah. But it's what kind of performance are we looking at? Is it like hundreds of megahertz, or and how can you even compare megahertz between different implementations? I guess it's different cycle counts depending on construction, depending on implementation as well.
Yeah, so this is very much a size for service, very much a size versus speed trade-off. So I made a movie last year which describes this in better detail, but basically regular CPU you work on a whole instruction word at once, so you work on 32 bits at once. When you do an addition, it will take one clock cycle, for example. For serve, you do it one bit at a time. So to do a 32-bit addition, it will take you 32 clock cycles. And this is a problem if you want a fast CPU, but in many cases, you actually don't need a fast CPU. If you're just doing, for example, if you're doing some sensor readings, you might read a temperature sensor once a second. You absolutely have no use for for anything faster than that. And it runs fine. You can run a simple real-time operating system. And also some very interesting things I heard about from users of Serve is that when they're doing FPGA implementations, they choose Serve because since it's so small and so simple, it's a lot faster to compile than other CPUs. So the turnaround times for testing out new things go from minutes to just like 20 seconds. This is a it's kind of innovation that opens up that you didn't think of initially. Another thing I wanted to do now when I had Serve and I realized you could put a lot of serves into FPGAs. So I created something called Core Score, which is a benchmark for FPGAs and for the FPGA tooling. And it basically tests how many serve cores you can fit into a single FPGA. And
how many can you fit?
it depends on the FPGA. Some smaller lattice size 40 boards, you get like 10 cores into it. The biggest one I have right now is a larger Xilinx device, which is able to fit 5,087 cores in it. I think that's probably the most RISC-V cores on a single chip. It's pretty cool.
Do you know how many microblazes they can fit in on the same? How much smaller is it than?
Oh, it's probably a lot smaller than a microblaze. I don't know how it compares to picoblaze. Picoblaze, I think that might be 8-bit also. But the thing here is that so what I think you should compare it to instead is more like 8051s or old 8-bit CPUs, because there are a lot of these old 8-bit CPUs in use because they are small. But the tooling around those are absolutely a disaster. So with Serve, you can use just regular GCC and your ordinary build tool chain, but you still don't have to pay for a big CPU in terms of gates.
Yeah. How does it look in the other end of the spectrum? I mean, we've seen the Apple M1. So I got myself a Pinebook Pro, and then Apple released their ARM machine, which is a crazy powerhouse, and mine is kind of slow. How how far in the other direction can you go in with RISC-V and the open source implementations?
I don't have the open source implementation. I don't know. I do know that the Boom CPU by Chris Celio and others, that has been traditionally a very fast CPU. It's an out of order CPU. I know that Ariane is a 64-bit Linux capable CPU that is becoming increasingly popular. It is now, Ariane has been adopted by the Open Hardware Group and is now called CVA6, I think. I think the old name was better. Then we have, of course, Western Digital Cores, the Swerve EH1. That was at the time when they released it last year, I think 2 years ago. It was the fastest 32-bit CPU. It had like a crazy good core mark score, something like close to Xeon for certain use cases with title coupled memory. So these are the ones. And then also it's not open source, but a small company called Micromagic just released a 5 gigahertz RISC-V core. I've been talking to Dr. Andy Wang, who's behind that recently. We're planning to do something about the fastest and the smallest RISC-V cores, kind of a joint thing.
But that's cool. So then you can go like multi-scalar, out of order, all the way on the same ISA that you do a 32 cycle. And you could basically, I guess, you can support all instructions in software on the serve. So you can be software compatible all the way through, or do you have to like recompile and then it's upwards compatible only?
You could emulate missing instructions on RISC-V. Everything, I think the atomic operations, you can't emulate all of them. That is, I read it in the spec somewhere. But other than that, yes, you should be able to emulate, probably very slowly, but still. So serve already emulates multiplication and division, which is not part of the basic instruction set. But you could go further. You could emulate floating point and vector instructions if so inclined.
It's just a matter of time.
It's just a matter of time, yeah.
No, but then I guess it's a bit like the back with Amigas and Ataris, where if you had an FPU, or if you didn't have an FPU, you got an interrupt, and then the operating system or the C library or whatever took over and did the actual calculation for you in software.
Yeah, exactly.
CPU, so I didn't see it. It just sees an unknown instruction. And
it makes it a known thing. It gives you a known answer back. So yeah, I think what RISC-V is especially the base instruction set specification is beautifully written. It's a work of art. It's very simple. It's also very versatile, and it was always designed with the intention to be extended, and that works. Of course, there are some areas where you didn't anticipate it, some needs, but mostly it scales very well.
Do you think that RISC-V will sort of replace ARM over time, or will ARM take over and become the desktop CPU now, and RISC-V becomes the embedded one?
I think that we have seen that it's very hard to break into new domains. So currently, ARM has a stronghold over the whole embedded market. MIPS used to have a good market cap in network equipment, but MIPS is just a sad story of greed and the licensing that went wrong. X86 has been the traditional desktop CPU, and it has been up until ARM and Apple, it has nothing has been able to move that. And in the high performance space, I don't know that much. I think Power and X86 are battling it out there. Also some ARM. So I think these are really are different battlefields. And even when it comes to embedded, it's the high-end embedded and the low-end embedded. So if in a CPU, or no, in a mobile phone, for example, you probably have 100 different CPUs. You have a CPU in your battery, you have a CPU that takes care of button pressures, you have CPUs in your monitors and in your audio equipment and in power management and everywhere. And I think that more and more of these low-end CPUs will be replaced by RISC-V CPUs. and it will crawl up from there. And then it will come a matter of, hey, we're already using RISC-V in most of these. Why don't we use RISC-V in the rest of them? And that together with more and more capable cores, I think it will slowly take over. That is my prediction. On desktop space, I don't know. I'm not sure how many... I'm not sure actually who uses desktop computers anymore. I do, but that's kind of because I'm... work
with computers in different ways. Farts, all of us, and sit in front of a desktop machine. But yeah, I mean, what's interesting to me is that, I mean, we had the whole Wintel thing going on for, what is it, 30, 40 years, and now it feels like the browser's sort of broken the Win part of it.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, Intel also loses the foothold, because when I work, 90% of what I do is actually web-based. I mean, email meetings, whatnot, so I don't really care about the CPU, and Apple is sort of proving that if you don't have the Windows compatibility to worry about, it's quite easy to port. And if the porting's been done once and you have the same tooling, I guess you have Clang support and so on in for RISC-V, then the next transition is a lot less painful, so to speak.
Yeah. And speaking of first transitions, I think ARM, I mean, RISC-V has been seen as the biggest threat to ARM in many ways, but I think, ironically, it's what ARM did that actually paved the way for RISC-V, because in 10 or 20 years ago, a lot of open source software and closed source software was completely x86 centric, and then people started using Linux on smaller devices, and then you suddenly had to make sure that it worked on more than one platform. And once you have more than one platform, it's much easier to add yet another platform. So a lot of the device or platform agnostic work that has been done for supporting ARM has greatly benefited RISC-V, I would say.
It'll be fun next decade. It feels much more unsure than 10 years ago. I mean, somehow I was too young in the early 80s where we had this sort of multi-actors ecosystem, but we're getting back there. Feels fun.
Yeah, it's I agree. It will be very interesting to see, and I think ARM will go strong for a while. I'm not sure now that NVIDIA is looking to buy them, because I don't see NVIDIA being all that interested in the licensing model. I think NVIDIA is more buying ARM for the AI stuff and maybe other type. I mean, ARM is not just about the CPU. They have the Axie bus specification. They have a lot of other IPs. So we'll see.
Yeah, that's an interesting move, definitely.
Yeah, it is.
I'm thinking for myself here. There's tons of like hacker heroes. In software like Kernighan, Ritchie, Thompson, Stallman, etc. Do you have any key hacker hero kind of style in open hardware, open silicon?
Yeah, we definitely have that. And I kind of feel bad for not mentioning people, but I think one person that should be mentioned is Claire Wolf. She has done very much work on opening up the EDA side of the tooling, being the first to document these lattice size 40 chips, which kind of paved the way for others to do the same thing. And she was not alone, that she is very much a forerunner here. Also, she's done lots of things in formal verification, which is interesting, but then a whole different story. And then, of course, we have people like, I mean, I always bit starstruck when I meet Dave Patterson. He's the mastermind behind RISC and things like that. Of course, there are a lot of people. It's very, very hard to mention. I would like to mention everyone in Fosse Foundation who has been working with for 10 years now, who are doing a lot every day to improve the situation on open source silicon. And many of these people are not seen. And I kind of a bit against also this hero worshipping thing, even if some people have done a lot of things. It is more that people are helping out each other. Some work in the background, some are very I mean, I like to be seen, so I am seen a lot. but other people don't enjoy that as much.
If you want to start out with like free software, open source development, a good tip is you can do like look into document stuff, solve an easy bug, or report a bug in a proper way. How can I engage in open hardware, open silicon?
Yes, there are a few different ways. I think you should reach out to us in Fuzzy Foundation. We have a chat room. We have mailing lists. Then you can ask people, think about what more exactly you are interested in. Are you interested in making things move? Are you interested in what areas you can help in? We are also participating in Google Summer of Code. I'm not sure we'll get in this year, but we've been for the past 4 or 5 years. I mean, of my personal project, I would recommend starting out with Project Led to Believe, just seeing that you can make a LED blink and then take it from there and experiment and make it blink faster, make two LEDs blink and things like that. And suddenly you have a whole RISC-V core. so that is, this step is surprisingly small, I would say, actually. Cool. So that is one thing. Also, Tim Ansel works at Google. He is a great voice in this community, and he's always trying to get more software people involved. And he's a whole list of things that he recommends things that people can work on if they're new in this domain. Also, the Fuzzy Foundation YouTube channel, we have all the presentations from all our events recorded there, so it could be a good source of inspiration if you want to get a bit more feel for what's going on.
Yeah, there will be a link in one of the corners. I'm not sure where on the screen I show up, but yeah, we will definitely link to that one.
Perfect.
So I know that you had one last question, Henrik.
No, I have a few, but let's see. What I'm seeing here and in software development is I'm seeing sort of like the, I don't know how to phrase this, and not setting people up, but there are some areas in software where you can say, have you reloaded the page, and you can get away with an error. Whereas in some other areas where I usually am, in the embedded world, there's no way you can say, can you reboot or whatever? So there's like, dare I say, sloppy programming and perhaps the quicker programming and the fail-safe programming. Do you have any like divisions like that in open hardware, open silicon, or is it you have to be 100% all the time?
No, so this is... If you're talking to people who have been around for doing ASIC stuff, especially in big companies and so on, they know that if you get the ship wrong, it's extremely expensive. And I've been working in places where ships have gone wrong, and it's very complicated and it's very expensive to redo. So some of these people are extremely paranoid about making sure that everything works. Sometimes they aren't very efficient in actually doing that. It can be more for their own feeling of safety. But then also we have standards like in automotive space, we have the ISO 26262, which puts high demands on things should not go wrong. And when they go wrong, you should always know why they went wrong, things like that. So there is a different safety culture and tolerance against errors in the hardware and the software space. But then we have FPGAs, which is kind of the middle ground here. If you have an FPGA in a system where you can access remotely, you can probably upload it. You can probably update it just like it would with other kind of firmware. So then it's more like a software problem. But of course, if it's in an engine in a car, which you don't have network access to, then it doesn't matter if it's reprogrammable because you won't go out and and reprogram every single car in existence. So the harder it is to fix and the longer time it takes to fix the the more paranoid you are about errors, I would say. But it's the same with software as well. If you send something out to space, it's not like, ah, yeah, we take this satellite down and just fix this thing and launch it again. Even if you can.
Go up and press the reset button.
Yeah.
So there's been some kind of open risks in space, if I remember correctly. Okay.
Yeah, so OpenRISC, I mean, that is RISC V is a better instruction set in most regards. But I think one thing that happened with RISC V was the perception, the change. So I know a lot of places where there are OpenRISC CPUs, like in critical telecom infrastructure. There's one on ISS, apparently, and there's been one in satellites and in digital TVs and in Zigbee controllers and everywhere. But no one talked about it. You would not find anyone who said this publicly. Oh, it's in tablet socks also from Allwinner. And then RISC-V came along and everyone was, hey, look at us, we're using RISC-V, check it out. Mm-hmm. And they made it into a press release. So this is very ultimately a very good thing, although a bit frustrating when we had been working on kind of basically the same thing and it's the world just... It's like I'm trying to push a train forward for many years and then suddenly it just takes off and now I'm trying to keep up with it instead.
Well, that sounds really good. I mean, we have the pivot, definitely, and the next decade will be very interesting, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Now we have the technical underpinnings and now we need to see. I think there will be very interesting things happening in the ecosystem around this, with companies forming that take open source solutions and build customized services around it, all these things that we have in the software ecosystem, where you can just start a company by an ID and don't have to pay tools for like hundreds and thousands of dollars. You can just get going.
Cool. Well, it sounds like we need to do an annual follow-up on this one. I think that's a good pivot to sort of to conclude for today. But thank you for these two episodes. It's been fun. And I hope people find it interesting as well, since open hardware is very close to open source and open software, but still slightly different.
Yeah, we're not welcome anywhere.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So let's book February 10th in 1 year, hopefully without COVID.
Perfect.
It's cool. A date.